So we are now recording, and I'm going to mute all with the ability to unmute yourself. And so just a reminder, we are recording the audio, and it'll get posted on our website probably later on tonight. The chat window is open for any questions or comments you want to make through there. You can unmute yourself at your leisure anytime you want to ask a question, make a comment, or whatever. Please remute yourself afterwards so that we don't have a bunch of background noise going on. And with that, I will kick it off to Alan to take us through tonight's deck. You're muted, Alan. Alan, you're muted. Yep. Oh, there we go. Okay.
The thing just popped up to tell me I was muted. So. Okay, so hopefully you see my first slide.
Yes, we do.
So welcome, everybody. As Chris said, we have quite a bunch of material to get through, so we'll start off. First thing we have is a follow-up from last week, I believe, on a problem with FTP. Chris?
Yeah, sure. So FTP, just a reminder, it's File Transfer Protocol. It originated in the days of Unix servers, of a way of transferring files from one computer to another primarily. And in the PC world, it's more often used than not to transfer files back and forth to a web server if you administer a web server. It's a way of getting your site in order. And the person who had this problem could connect to it, but they couldn't get a directory listing once they were connected. Next slide. So the most common issues with FTP I find is around the protocol itself. FTP normally uses two connections rather than just a single connection, which almost every other protocol seems to use, like a website. You connect to a website, and then on that connection, it sends data back to you. Well, FTP uses a control connection, which is initiated by the client, and then there's a data connection, which is used for actually transferring any other data about the FTP session, including directory listings and actually transferring files. That data connection is normally initiated by the server back to the client. That's a no-no when it comes to firewalls, because any connection that is not initiated by you, your firewall will normally block it as an attempted intrusion onto your computer or attack or whatever. So the solution for that is PASV mode, also known as just passive mode. And what that means is that both connections actually get established from the client and are therefore allowed by most firewalls. Most firewalls don't block outbound connections unless you specifically deem it that you want to do that. So in the problem solving, we established that, yes, indeed, the connection was getting established. So that first connection over the control channel was getting connected fine, and they were getting logged into their website so that they should have been able to transfer data at that point. PASV mode in the logging file, it was actually showing that PASV mode was getting initiated. And then immediately after that, the data connection, which is the directory listing, was failing. And there are two ways that listings can get done. List is actually a Unix form of it, and there's MLSD, which is another one, which I don't know the details about. But they can, either of those can be used to do directory listings. They tried with both, the list command as well as the MLSD, both of them were failing. And then they discovered that by disabling the McAfee firewall on their computer, it solved the problem. So obviously the McAfee firewall was not following the rules properly. The person who had the problem, it looks like, is probably just going to decide to do away with McAfee on his computer rather than trying to troubleshoot the problem. I suggest that he could contact McAfee and see why is McAfee blocking normal FTP traffic. But it looks like he's just happy with the idea that, yeah, disabling the McAfee firewall solved the problems, so he's willing to go along with that.
Hey, thanks, Chris. Tom is saying, if you use Windows Firewall, install Windows Firewall Control. Any thoughts on that, Chris?
Personally, I just use the Windows Firewall in its default configuration when I'm on a computer where I don't have GlassWire installed. I actually use a program called GlassWire, which works with the Windows Firewall to give an awful lot more control. In particular, what I really like about GlassWire is that any program on your computer that is trying to connect to the internet its first time, you can set it up so that GlassWire submits that executable to virustotal.com and gets it checked out by usually about 70 different antivirus products. So the free version of it allows the traffic to go and then submits the file to VirusTotal. So if you do have a problem that it's a malicious file, bad things have happened, but at least you find out about it immediately and can take steps to correct things. The paid version, which is what I'm using, it actually will block the traffic, puts up a pop-up, and you have an allow or a block, and then in the meantime, it's submitting the file to VirusTotal. You get the report back, usually in less than a second, and if it comes back saying 0 of 73 engines found, you know, this to be malicious, that's good enough for me, and I'll say allow, and then it'll allow that program in the future. So I use that. It works along with the Windows Firewall, but personally, I think that most people, unless you want something that sophisticated, the Windows Firewall by itself does the basics. It blocks inbound connections that you didn't initiate, and it allows all outbound traffic. And that's, generally speaking, what most people want. But, yeah, if you want more control over it, I'd certainly take a look at, additional programs like GlassWire that can layer on top of the Windows Firewall.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
Windows Firewall control does the same thing. If some program on your machine wants a way out, it brings up a pop-up, and you can see what's requesting it and where it's going. It's a free program. I think it was taken over by Hitman Pro or some other big antivirus thing now, but it's freeware. It allows you to, if you want to open openings to your programs, you can set what addresses it's allowed to go to. It's just a very nice interface to the Windows Firewall. Yeah. It gives you a lot of control.
My biggest problem with two-way firewalls like that pop up and say, do you want to allow such and such to access the internet? I can virtually guarantee you that at some point you're going to get a pop-up and you will have no clue how to answer it. You don't know if it's malicious or not. That's the thing that I actually really like about GlassWire, is that it submits the program to VirusTotal. And, hey, if VirusTotal comes back and says, like, 70 antivirus programs didn't find a problem with it, that's good enough for me. And so, like, I like that. I have used two-way firewalls in the past, and it's just, like, I find for the average person, that annoyance of having a pop-up that you maybe don't know how to answer, whether you want to allow the traffic or not, that gets problematic. But if you want the extra security with the possibility of extra annoyance, certainly it's a trade-off that some people might be willing to make.
Yeah, it is a bit more annoying because you have to look up the program and see if it's in a something you installed recently or it's an update. Like things from Google Update and from my Asus, who makes my computer, and so on. They change the program names, and so I need to re-allow them. But I take a look and see what directory they're in, and it's less of a problem than VirusTotal.
Yeah.
It's more of a problem than VirusTotal.
Yeah.
Okay, so our next item on the agenda is actually two items. Chris has coined this the ultimate guide to saving disk space. Now, you recall that we've talked about this in the past in terms of identifying duplicate files and especially photographs and how to clean things up. What then happened then was that Tom sent in a whole raft of tips, tricks, and traps that can help save disk space. He's put it together as a slide deck. And so, Tom, if you want to take control, I will stop sharing and you can go through your deck. And then after that, we'll have Chris follow up with his material. And Tom, you'll have to I know you won't. There we go. I was going to say you have to unmute yourself, but.
Okay.
There we go.
That's cute. Let me get to my, That's great. Resume slideshow. Here I am, I guess.
Yep, looks good.
Okay, so caveats, some of these things may be dangerous, so use at your own risk. The short form is this, the too long, don't read, didn't read. The easiest solution is buy more storage and just keep accumulating stuff. Second thing is you can clean windows up a bit by getting rid of stuff that you don't need. You can live dangerously and get rid of stuff which you probably should keep. You can compress disks and files. You can also look through your files and eliminate or link duplicates. You can also prune out unneeded stuff. And there's ways to do that. First thing, buy more storage. You can add an SD or a micro SD card, especially for tablets, netbooks, other things. You can put that in your own. Many laptops, and for that matter, have desktops, have slots for SD cards or micro SD cards, and they go up to 512 gigabytes. External disks can go up to 16 terabytes, which I think is about $400 for the 16 terabyte. Or you can repurpose old disk in a hard disk enclosure. I bought four of them on eBay, and I bought four different colors so that I could tell them apart. You can also buy a USB disk or a network attached disk. And the important thing here is that it should have a USB 3 or higher connection, because USB 2 is limited to about 30 megabytes a second, while the USB 3 is much higher than that. You can also attach by storage in a box that has 2 to 8 disks of 4 to 16 terabytes each. This is especially useful if you're a photographer or whatever, and you probably know already all about that. But one thing you should be aware of, if you have network attached storage, beware of exposing your network attached storage or disk to the internet. They may or may not be secure. I have read a number of things about the operating systems in them, and they're not very secure. You can also clean windows. There are in the settings, there's a storage and a storage sense. You can get rid of temporary files that are in your temp directory, delete files in your recycle bin. You can do a lot of things to get rid of stuff that you downloaded that you don't need, or that is downloaded that you won't need. So that's in settings, storage. You can also clean your disks separately for each disk. You can choose the things here as to what you want to get rid of. It'll tell you how much you can gain. You can also go over to clean up systems files, and that looks like this. This is the clean up systems files, and then this is stuff that you downloaded during updates. You can get rid of the stuff so you can't then go back to before the update, but that's sizable. It's 9 gigabytes here. Windows Defender, antivirus, other stuff like that, a variety of things you can get rid of off your disk. And now moving on to Living Dangerously. Oh, are there any questions? Apparently not. Okay. Whoops. Living Dangerously. You can disable hibernation. If you're using an SSD, hibernation uses up SSD disk writes, so, you know, basically the size of your RAM at a gulp. So that will reduce the life of your disk, the longevity of it. Hibernation takes space, but if you're on a laptop, hibernation can protect you from low battery conditions. If you're taking your laptop places, then it's worthwhile to perhaps enable hibernation. And there's information here in the presentation. You basically go to a command, run command in as an administrator, and then powerconfig.exe/hibernate-off, and that will free your hibernation file and not allow you to hibernate. You can also compress your disk folders files. I haven't heard recently of any in the last 10 years, you know, recently, of any problems with compression that have happened. It does mean that it's harder if you go to a disk manually to actually reassemble it or recover stuff. It makes it messier to recover it. You can't actually look at things. If the disk or folder or file is compressible, then it will look different. Some things are already compressed, pictures and audio and video, though you won't get any improvement using the Windows compression. If you do want to compress, you can use 7-zip or zip file compression. It's better, but it is clumsy to use because you have to put everything in a file and then open the file, or perhaps use, if it's a zip file, you can open it in the Windows Explorer to look at things, but it is it's clumsier to use, and you can't use it for any files that you want to easily access. It can be faster with a fast processor than accessing it on disk. If you have a reasonably fast processor and a slow hard disk, you can actually speed up your hard disk by using compression on the compressible files. It will cause more file fragmentation, but apparently Windows has gotten a little better at that. But the way that it works, I've explained it. I wrote the article, the section on file compression in NTFS. It basically takes 64K chunks and tries to compress them using LZ compression. And if it can, then you have a whole bunch of files of 64K logical sizes, but the actual physical size is smaller. And it can save a lot. I have the way you can do it for a disk, you can actually choose to compress the disk. And you can do this on any of your disks. And that is, if it's your system disk, then this is the safest way to compress it. I had problems way in the past where I compressed a disk, or I tried to compress files on a disk, I believe, on the C drive, and then it wouldn't boot up. And that was a pain to get back to working status. But if you do it here, it won't compress the things that it uses actually to boot up until it gets to the stage where it can actually decompress. For an OS disk, Windows handles boot files safely if you use this thing here. If you can save more on system disk using the compact command, and that will actually work a while, and it will give quite a high compression ratio, and it's most useful for netbooks or something like that where you have a 32 or 64 gig system disk that is flash memory of some sort. I have not tried this. But looking into compressions is what I found. So it apparently it works fairly well, 1.7:1, although, and that seems, in 3 gigabytes, that seems to be about as far as you can compress Windows, I would say. You can also compress folders. You can choose this. For example, you can run the documents folder and so on. And I can see here, some of these files are compressed, but you can see there's only a very small savings. In fact, there isn't any savings at all here on my C drive, but I haven't tried compressing it. But you can get more compression on your data disk or on stuff where there's a lot of repetition. EXE files have a lot of repetition as well, but also text files. So files, here I tried to take a look at the Microsoft Edge, at a log from Microsoft Edge, and I compressed it. And as you can see, the savings for the log file were impressive. That's about 3 to 1 or so, better than 3 to 1. So for log files, especially, and for files like documents and so on. Oh, by the way, for Windows Office and LibreOffice, the file types that end in X are already compressed. So don't bother compressing them. You won't get any advantage from them. That's something they've done the last 4 or 5 years that Windows didn't do before. But do not use them on particular on OS files. You can compress the OS disk, but don't compress files, or you may have trouble booting up. Pros and cons can save space, but not for audiovisual pictures or compressed documents. It can be faster with a fast processor, and especially with a slow hard disk. It's good for logs and repetitive files. It does tend to fragment files. It's probably slower when you're copying big files from one disk to another because it has to uncompress them, and then at the other end as it goes along. So it's probably slower when copying one compressed file to another compressed file. But I don't know. Our processors are pretty fast these days. It's only NTFS. It's not FAT32 or XFAT. USB and SD fast storage are usually better with have better performance and life using XFAT and FAT32. NTFS has 4K sectors, while XFAT and FAT32 have sectors that generally match the sectors in the flash disk of usually 128K. Not 4K. So NTFS will tend to use up your flash reads and writes, because to write a 4K sector on an SD or any kind of flash medium, you will be reading in 128, changing the 4K, and writing out 128. So you have a multiplication factor there of, 32? For the usage of the flash memory. I think most SSDs are smart enough to actually cache stuff and only write when they need to, but usually SD cards, other USB sticks and so on are probably not going to be that smart. Now, moving on to deleting duplicates. You can delete pair files. The way you do this is by comparing files of the same size and listing them if they have identical content. Usually the names and dates do not matter. These things are changed. This is metadata. And you can choose which to delete, which to keep. And there are a variety of programs that will do it. CCleaner has an option to do that. NurseSoft will do that. There are scripts for Power... PowerScript, and there are various other programs that will find files, and then you can take a look at them. They'll check that they're identical, and then you can choose which one to keep. But you can do something a little smarter than that. If everything's on the same disk, you can hard link the data. Basically, they must be on the same logical disk, NTFS only. And there are programs that will find duplicate files and then offer to create hard links to the duplicate data. Basically, it gets rid of all of the duplicates and then creates directory entries that point to the data that are created where the original files were in those directories. And that's a good way. I've done it myself when I've been running out of space for data. And that's a very useful tool. Windows will deliver the same data when any of the file names are accessed or edited. But, of course, don't make backups because you won't have a backup. Because when you make another change to the original, you're making a change to the backup at the same time, so it won't be a backup. There are also such things called soft links, but the links are far too fragile. They can go between different disks, but I would suggest avoiding them unless you really know what you're doing. There are the programs that I've run into. I think the one I've used here is the one in the middle, the dupe merge. But there are several other programs that will also do the same thing. Basically, they do the same as the previous programs, but they will offer to hard link them. And then you'll save the amount of the space that was occupied by the duplicates. Any questions?
Yes, Tom, there is a question. Corrine wants to know, do you need to do a backup before disk compression?
You don't need to, but it's always worthwhile. I have never seen or read of any difficulties with compression. You're not going to run out of space along the way. It won't use up more space. It doesn't put it someplace else and then put it back. So it's not really necessary. And you can, of course, you can uncompress at any time by going into Explorer and looking at the attributes and the extended attributes, and you can unclick compression, and when you apply, it'll uncompress it. Compression is invisible to all the programs that use it, and it's a good way of compressing, of getting stuff to be smaller. It's not really, really strong. It's only a very simple compression method. But as you can see, it's for log files where there's lots of duplication that can save 70%. Any other questions?
Hi, it's Corrine again. I'm not following hard linking duplicates. Can you give me an example of some files and then why you would hard link them?
Well, say you have a variety of pictures, and you want to keep them in one directory where they're easily accessible perhaps on a network or something, and you also want to keep them in another directory where you're basically using directories for managing projects or something, or using the same file in different projects and for use by different, for example, Microsoft Word can link files together and have includes. You could also use it for if you're compiling stuff. If you need to have things in the same directory, you can just, instead of actually specifying where the original is, you can just create a copy there and hard link it or have it hard linked. If you go through the duplicates, you'll find out where the duplicates are, and you may decide, well, yes, I want to have a copy both in both of these directories. I don't want to delete a duplicate. Mainly you hard link when you need to have it in two directories at the same time, but it should be the same file or the same data. Now, the reason why you would have two directories, that will vary. It could be your software wants to have things all in the same directory, and you have another piece of software that also wants to have things in its own directory. And so you can hard link it. And basically, a hard link is basically a directory entry. And instead of pointing to data that it owns, it points to data that is shared by all the hard links. Any other questions?
Hi. Just following on, it's Corrine again. So I'll give you an example. I'm doing, managing a budget for a project, managing expenses. And so I have some spreadsheets. and some Word documents. And what I've done, let's say in a spreadsheet is I've linked another piece of another spreadsheet in, but I don't want to lose that link, because then if there was an agreement on that, or we said, okay, we sent this out, everybody's agreed on this, then that's the final document. I wouldn't want to mess around with hard linking these, because then it would impact the authenticity of that budget report. Do you follow what I'm saying? Is, I guess it depends on.
That case,
go ahead.
Yeah, in that case, you probably would want to keep make that the copy, and for that matter, click on Read Protect, so
okay.
that applications
okay.
don't.
Okay. All I'm
so
getting at is I wouldn't go through this and say, gee, these look the same, and I'm just going to link them. The context is very important. For the example that I gave, is the context or the original file is important. So, I understand why you would use it, but it wouldn't necessarily help me out if I'm having different versions of different files for different reasons.
No, the way that I use it, there might be other software that uses it, is that when I start running out of space or worrying about space, or I have some big files, then I'll go through, use these programs, search out the duplicates, and then usually I'll delete the file, the duplicates, or delete one of the duplicates. Obviously, they're equal. but I'll delete one of them. But if I need to have it in both directories, and I do want it to be the same data, the same file, then I would hard link them. One thing I should say is that Windows manages these hard links very nicely. And you can delete any of the files, and it doesn't affect the other files. And you only lose the data. You know, data is only deleted when you delete the last file. So it's smart enough to realize that the data, as long as there's a link to it, it needs to exist. This also happens in Unix and Linux. They have the same kind of thing, and it's called the same hard link. In Windows, you can only do this in NTFS, which is the safest file system to use in Windows. Any other questions?
I think we're good.
You can also... I'm gone. Pruning stuff. You can also look through the stuff you have and delete the obsolete, bad, or useless, or large stuff you don't need. And in other words, not absolute duplicates, but for example, I tend to download the installation files for software that I use, and I keep it. I also copy the, if I've got a software that came on a CD, I copy the CD. Onto my hard drive. But sometimes at somewhere along the line, it's going to be useless or obsolete. And you may want to take a look at that and delete the, if you have LibreOffice and you have 10 versions of it you've downloaded, you may want to just delete 9 of them and only keep the most recent. And that way you can reinstall if you don't have internet access. And you can reinstall if you have some big disk problem, well, the other disk. One thing that's useful in this is Everything by voidtools.com. You can sort all your files, or you can search those files by name, so you can find all the LibreOffice installation files, for example. Or you can find all the other versions of your software, and then you can choose, well, which one is the one I want to keep. Also, when I do download software, I usually put the version number in the name so that it's fairly easy to tell. Otherwise, you can go into the file itself, the .exe file, and check to see the version number. It's among the properties if you look through the properties. For photos, you can use Lightroom or Darktable to look through photos, to delete, tag, star, or send to people. I mean, if you're going to go through them, you might as well do everything you want to particular photos. And sending them to people that are in the photos is an example. Install files. Do you really need all of them? Videos, do you really need them? Or should you just rip them to a DVD and hope it lasts? Or maybe you want to rip them to a DVD and send them off to somebody by mail. Videos, of course, are really huge, and you may want to consider whether you really want them. You could also use something like Handbrake to make them smaller if you really wanted to, but usually you want more detail, not less. Are any applications, are you still using those applications? Documents, are they still useful to you? Has that something that you've put behind you? You may want to delete a whole directory of things. So prune stuff. And that's it.
Hi, it's Corrine again. Just going back to the pruning, I think the example that I'll give is tax files, and you have an obligation to keep, if everybody's using electronic files, to keep it for 7 years, depending if it's an estate or a business. There are different rules, but I guess I would add to say, not that they're still useful, but do you have an obligation to keep them for a certain number of years?
Yes. What I would do in that case is actually put them in a directory by themselves and then use 7-zip to make it smaller, give it a good name that has all the information on it. Names can be up to 255 characters or so. So I would, if you're putting a project away and it's finished and the agreement has been made and things have gone on, I would put it in a directory and then zip that directory up with 7-zip and give it a really good name so that you can find it again, and then stash it away where you have stashed all your other files.
Okay.
You're done with.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions or comments? I'm finished.
Hey, thanks a lot, Tom. Alan, if you can bring up your deck. I had a couple of other things that I just thought were useful additions to this idea of the ultimate guide to saving disk space. And I hope we can add to this later on, too, so it can be sort of a living document in essence as well. So, Alan, there we go. Okay, so there were some other options that I thought of for finding and removing duplicates, and Tree Size Free is a great program, runs very quickly, allows you to slice and dice your data a bunch of different ways to easily look at types of files or files by size or date or anything like that. CCleaner, which Tom mentioned already, awesome duplicate photo finder was reviewed by Alan in the last issue of the newsletter. So if you're specifically looking for photos, one of the nice things it can do is find photos that are not identical but very close. And so they might find a minor edit done to a photo, and so maybe you don't need to keep both copies of it or whatever. And then Tom did mention search my files as well from NERSOFT, which is a free utility as well. CCleaner, if you are using it, be cautious about how you use it. In its default configuration, when you first bring it up, if you just say go ahead and clean things up, it will probably delete a lot of stuff that you actually don't want deleted. So be very careful about going through the list of things that it can delete and deciding whether you want to delete things or not. It can do things like, you know, your jump lists when you right-click an icon on the taskbar. Well, I don't want to get rid of my jump list, plus they don't take an awful lot of disk space, so you know, I'm not worried about things like that. So my recommended settings, so this deck will be available afterwards. If you go into the custom clean section, On the Applications tab, there every browser that you have installed on your computer, other than Microsoft browsers, will be listed. And for all of them, I would go in and check off Internet Cache and Compact Databases. And that can save a lot of space, and those definitely don't need to be saved. So they'll rebuild as necessary. If you use Thunderbird as a mail client, it'll be listed. And for that, I check off Internet Cache and Compact Databases. And there's a Windows tab, and it will list all of the Windows browsers, including Internet Explorer, Microsoft Edge, and Edge Chromium, the latest version of Edge. And under Edge, you can clear Internet Cache. Under Edge Chromium, you can do Internet Cache and Compact Databases. And for Internet Explorer, it's deleting temporary Internet files and the index.dat files. So I recommend having those all cleaned. And then on the Windows tab, there's some other sections. So there's under the System section. You can check it to delete temporary files. Some people prefer not to delete temporary files because at least in the short term, it's a possibility that if you have a crash or whatever, that a temporary file in there will have something useful for you. But generally speaking, temporary files are pretty safe to delete. Definitely memory dumps and check disk file fragments are safe to delete. Memory dumps are, as the name implies, it's just a dump of the memory area that is used by either Windows or an application, depending on what crashed. And check disk file fragments are just parts of files that are allocated, but they're not allocated to any particular file. So they're basically just being used on the disk, and they're not allocated to any files, so useless. And under the advanced, I also delete old prefetched data, because that is stuff that can get rebuilt automatically if it needs to.
Regarding memory dumps, they if you get a blue screen of death, you get a memory dump will be created. And if you keep getting it and you need to take it to be fixed because it's hardware or software beyond you, then those memory dumps may be useful. You may want to keep them if you keep getting blue screens of death. But otherwise, if you don't need to take it in for repair, it's not useful.
Yeah, the trouble with memory dump is that it's usually only usable by the company that wrote the software that crashed. And I have never had Microsoft request a memory dump. I've never had a third-party vendor request a memory dump. And if you are in that position and you are having repeated problems, you can probably recreate it, the crash. And at that point, if you've been asked for a memory dump, you'll be able to get another one and then save that one. As a general rule, they're just going to use up disk space, and they can be gigabytes of space that get chewed up by memory dumps. CCleaner has a section for registry cleaning. The first link there, the quote out of it is, registry cleaners don't fix problems, they invent them. Microsoft absolutely does not support the use of memory cleaners, and I put in the link to that. The registry in its early days of Windows 95 certainly had some issues. The registry is a self-cleaning thing. The registry cleaners will find inconsistencies in the registry. Anytime you run one, it will find inconsistencies. They are of no consequence. Okay, so Microsoft does a pretty good job of keeping the registry clean, and it's highly recommended that you don't use registry cleaners. And another thing I had was removing Windows 10 apps. If you go into the settings and apps and you try to remove one of the apps that came with Windows, you probably won't be able to remove it. However, if you use CCleaner tools uninstall, it can successfully remove things like photos and mail and various other apps that were part of the Windows 10 build. And it will remove them. You can reinstall them from the Windows Store if you decide later on that you need them. Be aware that every feature update, which is usually twice a year, and the spring and the fall, all of those built-in apps are going to get reinstalled. And so if you are trying to save that space, anytime you get a feature update to Windows, use CCleaner tools, uninstall, and remove them again.
One thing regarding registry cleaners. if I can go back for a second.
Yep.
I have sometimes my computer gets or has gotten confused, huh? And in those cases, I do you know, a check disk and a DISM and some file cleanup. I have also one of the things I do when I do that is to run a registry cleaner to clean out the registry as well. I don't know whether it is strictly helpful, but I've gotten back to some form of normality using those tools. In fact, I have a special batch file that runs DISM and system file cleaner in a batch file. I can copy it into the chat for people who want to use it. Basically, it returns Windows to some kind of sanity when it got confused.
Yeah, Mark Rusinovich, who wrote NTFS-DOS, the first program from the DOS and early Windows days that could write to an NTFS volume outside of the Windows native ability. Very smart guy. He wrote sysinternals, a lot of very useful apps. He absolutely swears do not run a registry cleaner. And he is now... with Microsoft, he heads up their Azure program, so possibly some of it comes from his fact that he actually works for Microsoft now, but he's a whole heck of a lot smarter than me, and he says not to run it, so I won't. So if you do decide to run it, buyer beware. That's all I'll say on that. Okay, so for browsers that do allow it, you can set the cache size to something smaller than its default, which could be as much as a gigabyte of space being used by the browser just for its cache. So if you can't set the cache size to a more reasonable size, then empty the cache periodically. You can do that with CCleaner, or you could do it within the app itself. And currently, as I've seen it, you can't set the cache size with Chrome and Edge. You can set Edge to delete cached files when you close Edge, and it'll just empty the cache completely. So it's safe to do that. It will make it a little bit slower going to some websites sometimes because it'll have to reload some data that perhaps it could have gotten out of the cache instead. Another thing is removing crapware that the manufacturer of your computer installed automatically in your computer. Usually it's best to do that when you first get the computer, and then you can more easily identify those programs that you can just say, well, I don't really care about that. Whereas if you do it 2 years later, you might look at something and say, oh, I don't really recognize that, but I don't know if I use it. So it's often easiest done when you first get a computer. You can turn off disk indexing if you don't use disk indexing. So if you don't do it where you click on start button or the search button and then search for contents of a file or something like that, or even just the location of a file name, and you can turn off disk indexing if you don't use that facility. So the way to go about doing it is you go to start and go to compute, you right click on the start button and choose computer management. And in the left hand panel, there'll be a services option. You click on services and applications, and then underneath that, choose services, and it'll list about 50 or 60 different services that are running on your computer, and you double-click on Windows Search, and there'll be a button that you can click on to stop the service. Then you can set the start type to disabled, and then you can end up deleting the existing index. So if you go to settings, and search for indexing options, it'll actually load a control panel applet for indexing options. And then if you go on to the advanced button, there'll be an option to delete and rebuild index. And you just click on rebuild. Now, what'll happen is it won't actually rebuild it because you've disabled the service, but it will delete the existing index. So it's a multi-step process you have to go through once, but you can save up to, depending on your circumstances, you might save as much as a gigabyte of disk space just with the search index.
The other thing I'd note there, Chris, I found that the Windows indexing process doesn't always find the files that I'm looking for. So I use this technique of yours to turn off the disk indexing. It works really well. Yeah. And then what I do is I use the program that Tom mentioned called Everything, everything is a search engine, a disk indexing engine. It's really fast, and it finds everything everywhere. It's just an amazing program.
Oh, good hint.
But it only works on names, so it's useful for names of files and directories. For contents, I used to use a program whose name escapes me right now, but I haven't found it, but it stopped working for me. Coppermine or something like that.
Copernic.
And they had a bunch of programs, but they seem to have stopped supporting them, or at any rate. Has anybody found a good program that indexes your contents of documents and files nicely and quickly and transparently?
I've actually found that the disk indexing built into Windows actually works pretty well. Its default configuration doesn't index a lot. Well, it does index a lot. It definitely will catch all of the files that are in your libraries and things like that. But you can easily go in and change what areas of your disk are getting indexed. So personally, I found it to actually be useful. So I do use it. But it's just, if you don't use it, definitely worthwhile to just turn it off, and that way you won't be chewing up the disk space. It doesn't impact the performance on your computer because it runs as a low-level service, so it's a low-priority service. It typically runs only when your computer is sitting idle and just indexes in the background. As soon as you start using your computer, the indexing engine will step aside and stop doing anything until it's idle again. I haven't used any other third-party indexing programs for many, many years. If anybody else has experience, good or bad, with indexing services, if you wanted to chime in or put a comment into the chat, that would be great.
Well, that was really good. So thanks to Tom and Chris for lots of good information there. So if anybody's trying to free up some disk space, you have one or two techniques that you could at least try. Okay, well, the first question of the night is a note on technology to use a smartphone to basically drive an elevator. And this came in a CTV news program. And it turns out this system is called Contactless Access. And it's a phone app that's developed by an Ottawa company called Protodev Canada. And the answer is it uses Bluetooth to connect to devices which are installed on secure doors, elevators, and that kind of thing. There's also a similar app which is created by Schindler Elevator Company. It seems to be a bit more powerful. The system will basically install on the phone again. And when you arrive at a building, if you have a controlled access, then the phone gives you access to the building. And it unlocks doors. It switches on lights in your office. But it's kind of smart. It learns when you get to work and you go home from work and when you go to lunch. And so it sets up a whole bunch of things to start with. So, for example, when you arrive at work, it calls the elevator for you and pre-selects the floor that you're going to go to get to your office. And then by the same token, at lunchtime, it knows you're going to go for lunch at, 12:15. And it again calls the elevator, but this time it sets the floor for the food court. And the other neat thing it can do is if you have a visitor to this secure building, if it's so secure, you may not have a guard, an actual person. So now the people phone you and you send them an authorization code by text message so that they can now access the door and the elevator and that kind of thing. So interesting technology. How far it's going to go, I guess we will find out. Tom says the apps seem to be overkill, I guess. But, you know, if you have a secure building, you save on personnel and maybe you provide a whole bunch of convenience. So it might not be a bad thing.
Hi, it's Corrine. I would say that if you're disabled and you have limited functionality with limbs and stuff, and, you know, pushing the elevator to open and close, it probably is a good idea. I think that's how they explained it. The context was,
If you check the website, Corrine, you'll see both of them talk about it being used to disable people.
Yeah.
The trouble is that it really requires the elevator to be modified to set this up, right? So it's not like you're going to be able to go and just randomly go up to an elevator and have it work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But remember, this particular one here is made by Schindler Elevator Company.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, clearly it has to be enabled. It's Bluetooth, so you have to have both ends working.
Yeah.
Anyway, there you go. Now, the next thing is a share, and this is one of Chris's favorite addiction complaints, I guess.
I love complaining. I think we pay lots of money for products, and we shouldn't let the people who write these products get away with the shoddy things that they often do. My latest was a bug in Fancy Zones that I ran across with the latest release, where if you're editing your zones, the way you split your zones, you could do it horizontally but not vertically until you had actually done one, and then you could do it either horizontally or vertically. So there was obviously a bug in the program. It wasn't a real killer, but it was obviously an error in the program. So I reported it through the button within Fancy Zones that says report a problem. And within 30 minutes of reporting it, I got an email thanking me for reporting the bug. And so within that 30 minutes, they presumably had verified that, yes, it was a bug, and I'm hoping it'll actually be fixed in the next release. Some of my recent feedbacks that I've had through the Windows Feedback Hub, I had an error opening PowerPoint files that came from the Internet, which I reported here at one of the Q&As. That has been fixed. I don't know if it was my reporting that caused it to be fixed, but it definitely has been fixed since I reported it. Under controlled folder access, I put in an enhancement request to make it easier to allow an app to be run against a controlled folder access. That has been upvoted 466 times, and a very good enhancement has been added since then. Again, I don't know if it was mine, but certainly Microsoft listened to somebody, and they fixed that up. I put in a complaint about calculator not following Windows color scheme, which drives me absolutely nuts when their own apps don't follow the Windows color scheme. It's only had 3 upvotes, and it has not been changed yet. And the weather app, I put in a feature request to add a date picker for historical weather so that I could go, and if I'm planning a trip, you know, next July 3rd, I could go and pick July 3rd and pick up historically what the weather has been on that particular date. And it's only been upvoted 3 times, and I haven't seen a change yet. So I'm batting, you know, 500. Well, actually, with the Fancy Zones, I guess I'm actually I'm batting about 666 or thereabouts. So not too bad.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And a couple of things in the chat. Lawrence is saying that you can even use Windows indexing to read files if you add the extension and turn on the capability. And he said it's an excellent tool for managing scripting files. And Corrine is recommending a session on file management and to include disk indexing in that content. So if that sounds good to anybody else, if you want to drop something in the chat, we'll certainly consider doing something like that. We'll consider it anyway, but if we got more upvotes, we'd do it much more reasonably, I think. Right. One of the things that came out of our survey was how to choose security software for computers and smartphones. And nobody volunteered to give a presentation on that, so I'm going to give you my thoughts. And some of you will be horrified, no doubt, and you can chip in with your thoughts or put comments in the chat, whatever. Basically, in terms of computers, I take a leaf out of Chris's book, find something that works, and keep it up to date. I've been using Windows Defender, like Chris has been using Windows Defender for a number of years. It's built into Windows 10. It works really well. It's never found a virus on my system. So that either it doesn't work at all, or I'm very careful what I download. And the good thing about it is it's regularly updated by the Windows Update process. And Chris noted that AVTest, which is a company which specializes in evaluating security software, gave it a perfect score for protection, performance, and usability a few months ago. Now, the next question is, what about smartphones? I mean, clearly, for a smartphone, you can't use Windows Defender because smartphones don't run Windows. And so typically, you're using Android, but you've still got dozens of choices. So how do you go about choosing something that's going to work for your phone? Well, my technique is basically to review the reviews. I go on the internet. I do the best of Android antivirus software or malware software, and then look at the reviews and see which ones I think are trusted sources. Clearly, you can't believe everything you read on the internet. And I generally restrict my options to free software because I found that free software it works really well. And if it doesn't work really well, then I can throw it away and just use a different piece of free software until I do find one that works. However, just bear in mind, I'm sure everybody knows that not all free software is always free. I mean, some of the products are actually trial versions, time limited. Sometimes they're bugging you all the time, annoyingly, to upgrade to the premium version. And almost certainly you'll be stuck with some kind of advertisements. But you can, in fact, do some kind of search on Google. As I say, look for the best free Android antivirus software. And you notice one of the things it picked up here was that AV test organization and giving the latest, at the time, the latest results for the different programs. And then a couple of other ones here, TechRadar. I've used some of their reviews in the past. And Android Authority, Gary Sims explains. I quite like their site for a number of different things. And when I looked at those things, I was using one product for a while, but it was annoying, so I looked for something else, and I ended up with a Sophos product. It's now Intercept X for mobile. You see it's free software. and this is a review from Android Authority. And right at the bottom here, it says they don't recommend virus apps, but if you're going to have one, try this one first. So that's a pretty good recommendation in my book to at least try it. It scores really well on AV test all across the board there. It's right here all across the board. They haven't tested it for a while, but it was perfect 666 all across the board last time they did test it. This is basically what it looks like. It has a splash screen as it boots up, and then it goes into this thing right here, which is showing all green. Everything is good to go. If you click on this button, it will do a scan of your system. It may find some problems. For example, on an early version, one of the first times I ran the program, it said, fine, you've got the latest Android version and your Wi-Fi security is good, but there are problems with Android compatibility. The version you're using is not the same one that Google are providing. Your phone is rooted and your phone is not encrypted. Well, that's fine. I mean, I know that because my phone is running a custom ROM. So it's not using Google's Android. It's a custom version. And I know that my phone's rooted, and I know that my phone's not encrypted. So what I can do there is, when it pops up root status is a possible problem, I can just tell it to ignore that check in future. So I don't have to deal with that, and I see all greens, and I'm aware that it thinks there are other problems, which aren't really problems. So some thoughts from Chris. I don't know whether you want to go over these, Chris. No, you don't. I'll do them for you. Basically, coming from his Protect Your Computer session at the library, pick one and stick with it. Don't chase the latest news on which is the best, because the best today is going to be the fifth best tomorrow, and the lists do vary over time. So pick one that works and then keep it up to date. That's really important. And if it's a product that Windows Update doesn't update by itself, make sure that you run the update that's necessary. But maybe take a look every year or so to ensure that the one that you're using is still in good stead with trusted reviewers. So nobody's put any nasty comments in the chat window, so I'm taking you all agree with me.
Of course, Alan.
Now we can move on and say, are there any other questions? Because we're a few minutes over.
One thing I would like to add for desktops, for PCs, is take a look at, I put it in the notes, Configure Defender. It's on GitHub. I have it now set to high in my system, and I haven't run into any problems running things. So I would suggest looking at it. There's also, I sent a thing earlier. Maybe I can take a look for it. There is a PC security YouTube channel, and they took a look at Configure Defender, and they ran it at the highest settings, where basically it's really tied down, and it's a lot more work to handle it. And basically, it was 100% successful against, I don't know, 1,200 or 1,500 different viruses and ransomware. So anyway, take a look at Configure Defender, and I would suggest trying it out.
I'd like to add to that. I've never actually used Configure Defender, but I love apps like that, because one of the problems with Microsoft software in particular, I find, is that the configuration options that they provide to you are not necessarily presented in the most understandable fashion, or they might be spread across multiple screens and things like that. Whereas if you use something like this Configure Defender, you have one location to do all your configuration, and they may actually provide you with additional granularity in how you configure the product beyond what Microsoft provides for you. So definitely worth looking at things like that. It's free, so why not try it out? And it may help you to protect your computer.
Okay, thanks. So we're a few minutes over, so I guess we'll wrap it up. I'll just remind you that next week is our regular monthly meeting. It is Remembrance Day, and we have a topic-specific presentation by Bob Walker, Computers at War. So look forward to that. And then later in the month, the library starts its Tech Cafe sessions again with the user group. And on the 23rd of the month, at 4 in the afternoon, Lawrence has a presentation, Scam Avoidance and Trust. And I remind you that you need to register for that session with the library, because they send out the log-on credentials. And then finally, our next Q&A will also be next week on the 11th, following Bob's presentation. If you have any questions or topics that you want to share, send them along to our suggestion box. And thanks very much, everyone.
Just a final that Tom pasted into the chat window, Windows Firewall Control. So yet another third-party way of controlling Windows software. So if you're interested in additional control, you might want to check that out.
Yeah, so it's it's very much nicer than the interface Microsoft provides. You can see all the logs, you can see the rules, you can sort them by all the characteristics very easily. It's a line per, so it's easy to see everything. And you can also create rules from the logs so that you can allow or block based on what's in the log and with the ports and everything. It's just a really, really nice way. I've looked at what Windows Firewall before, and it's a royal pain. This makes it very easy.
Yeah, very cool. And I'd like to pass along thanks to Tom for stepping up and giving a presentation tonight. That was really informative. He went into a lot of great detail on saving disk space. If anybody else has, you know, something they'd like to share with the group, doesn't have to be big and involved. It could be just a neat app you've come across or a neat technique that you've come across that you'd like to share, by all means, send in information about it to suggestionbox@opcug.ca, and we can talk with you about how to set it up, whether you want us to present a deck on it and you just talk to it, you just want to talk to it, or if you want to present something or a demo, whatever, we can fit it in. So by all means, if you have anything you want to share with the group, let us know. And with that, thanks very much to everyone for showing up tonight.
Don't forget to stop the recording, Chris.
Yes, I will, right?